And with that, I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight, Allie C. from Culpeper.
I got all my beverages, like old habits die hard. I think I have to have two beverages. Hi, family. My name is Allie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Allie.
I'm glad to be here. Let me see. Should I adjust this at all, or is it okay? Okay. I think I can see everybody. Good. Okay. That would be good. Hi. I love all the people on the screen, too. There we go. Good. So, yes, I'd like to just open with a prayer that centers me, if that's okay, the set-aside prayer. God, today help me set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, for a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, a new experience in you, God, and a much needed new experience in my own recovery. Amen. And I always try to ask God just to make me a channel for the message of hope that we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous and remove any ego BS or fear or anything like that, that inevitably comes with speaking. So yes, I'm going to ask God to make me a channel. So thank you, Billy, for asking me, and Lynn, I know Lynn was behind that too. Thank you for asking me. I love being kind of the pinch hitter here. It's good. But I've always loved this meeting. I used to come here before. My home group now is Sperryville, and in Sperryville, the music group at 6 p.m. on Sundays. So I don't get to come here anymore, so I'm grateful to be here tonight. My sobriety date is December 24th of 2018, so I just recently celebrated 3 years clean and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor who got sober 2 months before I was born, and I had the honor of presenting her with her 40-year chip a few weeks ago, January 2nd, at the Sperryville group. That was just beautiful, beautiful experience. I always age myself when I tell her tell that story, but I sponsor two women and I have a home group, which I already talked about. So I consider myself an everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is what keeps me going in here. I'm not a meeting a week kind of girl, like not comfortable that way. So how comfortable do I want to be? And that's determines my involvement in this program. So yeah, so I was talking about the thinking about kind of reflecting before the meeting on the background of this meeting to me. And as I walked up, I was looking at the stoop out there. And I remember sitting out there on the stoop, not sober, with Lynn, and in a really bad way. And it was probably, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, because I hadn't fully surrendered to this thing yet. So I knew the answer was here. Like I knew the solution was here. I knew where to go, and I wanted to be here. I wanted so desperately to have this sobriety. And I was working with Lynn, and Lynn was sponsoring me. And I would just come, and I just would say, I'd sit on the stoop and I would cry. And I would just tell her, I'm not sober. I had a few glasses of wine before I came, and I don't know if I can do this. And we would sit in the back room and read the big book, and she would just walk me through this thing. So being able to come back here is pretty powerful, and to be sober today and comfortable in my sobriety is really, really powerful. So I like to just read one paragraph in A Vision for You, because this paragraph describes my drinking, the last few years of my drinking, more, I think, better than I can describe it. So it's just that first paragraph on 151 in A Vision for You. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good, but not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. And that is a perfect description of the last few years of my drinking. It was always one more attempt and one more failure. And I just couldn't figure out why this wouldn't stick. You know, I was coming to meetings. I always had a sponsor because I knew that's what you were supposed to do. And it looked good to have a sponsor. And I knew just enough. I feel like knew just enough of the program and the literature to be dangerous because I was really good at memorizing. I'm a great student. So academically, I was able to, you know, recite the literature and sound good and show up to meetings, but I had not made that concession in my innermost self. So what it was like, I'm going to try to keep my qualification brief, because I was told as alcoholics, we all know how to drink. What I need to hear is how to stay sober. But I tend to go down rabbit holes because it is like something different comes up, you know, each time I look at my past. But I had a very happy family, a very happy childhood. My parents are still married. You know, there was no abuse. There was no, I did not have an alcoholic parent. I had like two alcoholic uncles, one on either side, but there was never any toxicity. You know, you hear horror stories in here. I think a lot of us come from backgrounds of abuse and drunk parents and toxic family. I did not have that. So it didn't make sense to me, you know, why am I like this? But I was always anxious. You know, I was always like an anxious child and always felt less than from very early age. I mean, I was very smart. Like I was a really good student and really smart and did well in school. So I always felt like I had to prove myself. You know, I always had to be, I couldn't get a 97%. I had to get 102%, you know. It was just that feeling of always having to overachieve to appear just equal. You know, I just wanted to be on par with what I saw in everybody else, which was delusional really in hindsight, but what I thought everybody else had, you know. So that anxious apartness is really identify with that a lot. So when the opportunity presented itself to drink at 12 or 13, I was all in. I remember just feeling like anything to make me feel a part of, anything to make me fit in. We've all heard those descriptions, you know, of something lit up inside me when I first took the first drink, and when it stopped burning, something lit up, and all those descriptions. And that really was my story too. I felt like I could breathe for the first time. Like I was able to just be, you know, just be and not have that, that anxiety that was pretty present all through, in social situations. So I remember that feeling, and, I made that decision, you know, at 13 or 14 to drink as much as I could and as often as I could. And so as a teenager, it was just drugs and alcohol. And I still did well in school, again, because I think I was just lucky enough to be able to excel so I could do the bare minimum. I graduated with honors in high school. I don't know how that happened because I was drinking a lot and partying and not showing up to school. But, you know, I remember that feeling of wanting to drink as often as I could. So I quickly got into the crowd. My daughter's 11 now. And so I remember that feeling of like, my parents must have been mortified, but like hung out with the older kids. I hung out with the kids that smoked cigarettes, that skipped school, that drank. And I like fit in immediately. Like that's where I wanted to, I gravitated towards the older kids, the cool crowd, you know? And so I immediately started at 17. I started dating a 26-year-old man. And that was perfect because he could get me booze, you know, and it worked out really well, cigarettes and alcohol. And so he was a 26-year-old drug dealer who drank the way I did, partied the way I did. And it was, you know, it was exactly what I needed to like catapult my alcoholism into its full glory, really. So I pulled my first geographical at 18, and I didn't know it was a geographic at the time, but I fled the state of Florida to Georgia with this man to escape a drug warrant that he had. and ditched my full scholarship to University of Florida that I had. And didn't even think twice about it, you know, did not even think twice. It was just like, this is where I can get more booze, drink the way I want to, and live the party lifestyle that I wanted to. So I ditched that scholarship and moved to a trailer park in Georgia with this man, and lived a romantic lifestyle of cocaine and booze and abuse. And it was my first real experience, I think, with like self-degradation that goes with my alcoholism. It just goes really well. So my trauma, you know, was not a childhood trauma. My trauma was self-inflicted. So it was a part of my disease. We manufacture our own misery. I really identified with that as well. So this is the lifestyle I lived through my 20s. And then I had my first DUI in 2004. So my only DUI, actually, I say that, but I never had another DUI, surprisingly, which especially later in my drinking, but I had one DUI in 2004, and I was drinking and driving constantly. I mean, it was just bar hopping and pre-gaming with alcohol before going to the bar, drinking at the bar until last call, and then driving home or driving to wherever the next party was, and drinking till 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning. It was just like repeat over and over again. So I got that DUI, and it was everybody else's fault. I was a young liberal feminist, you know, belligerent child, really. I mean, I was early in my early 20s. And it was everybody else's fault but mine. I remember thinking the cop profiled me because I had liberal bumper stickers on my car, so he must have pulled me over because of that, and making up all these excuses. But really what happened, I was blacked out and I was swerving, you know, all over the road. And so so it's all, you know, hindsight's 20/20. But I was first introduced to AA after that DUI, because I had to do VASAP and the mandatory meetings. And I remember hating Alcoholics Anonymous and thinking that it was not the place for me. I remember going to that meeting, I think it was in Manassas, in a church, the Trinity Church, actually, in Manassas, and thinking that it was all just a bunch of really angry white men. And I was a young woman, and I was so belligerent, and I was atheist, and I couldn't identify. I had so many prejudices against Alcoholics Anonymous, against God, against you, that I couldn't see the message. I couldn't hear the message. So I came, I did the absolute bare minimum. I came late and left early and sat in the back with my arms crossed and refused to pray at the end. And so I stayed drunk, is what the result of that was, you know. Just finished the requirements for that, because I'm a good student. So I had to finish the requirements, and then went back to drinking. So, you know, that thinking about that next time period was, I was living, so I met my now ex-husband, but we drank the same way. So moved into my friend Rachel's house, which was this, it was like the party house of the whole city. We had live bands. I mean, we worshiped alcohol. It was all we did. And it was like a ritual event, you know, and thinking about it in hindsight, it was, we had ice luges, we would hire live bands, we'd hire strippers, and we had these parties there that was, it was a worship of alcohol and drugs. And I felt like that I had arrived thing. I hear that and I'm like, oh, I am just, this is the life, you know, this is the life that I've always wanted. And it was a disaster, you know, it was a disaster. But at the time it was like, everything was still held together. You know, I was going to college. I got my license back after the DUI. It was like family was okay again. I'd left that abusive guy and got, you know, I'm moving up into a world of like acceptability, you know, because it was socially acceptable. The way I was drinking at that time was still socially acceptable. So, you know, just the party lifestyle, the music, the way we were living, I started having this like stinging sense that something was not that I was not like everybody else, that I was not drinking like everybody else. That, you know, it's a pretty low state of affairs when your drug dealer says, I think you may have a problem. I was in a, you know, I was the one that always drank longer than anybody else. You know, like it, we'd be at a party and it'd be social drinking and it would be fun and shots. But I was the one after everyone had passed out and I'm still up at 5 or 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning, digging through your refrigerator to try to find the leftover booze. You know, if we were doing dry alcohol, it was, I always had a personal stash and I was the one in the bathroom not being social. I was the one hiding, you know, doing what I was doing. So it was starting to kind of, I was starting to have this sense that I was not, that I was bodily and mentally different from my fellows, even in that early stage. So I figured getting married would fix me, and having a baby would fix me. So I did both, and it didn't work. I had a beautiful home birth with my first daughter, and I wanted this pregnancy and this birth to be pure. You know, nothing else in my life had ever been unmedicated or pure. So I did not drink during that pregnancy. And I had a home birth in the water with no drugs, and it was beautiful, you know, and it was like the most transformative. And I finally felt like I had a spiritual experience during that. I felt connected. I felt whole. I felt confident and I was sober, and it was, I thought, you know, maybe this is the turning point. And within 3 weeks of giving birth to Leah, I was drinking again. And it was just, I remember that, I think that was probably the first time that I was really aware of like the phenomenon of craving, of how I told myself, you know, I had this infant and I justified in my brain, I'm just going out for 2 drinks with my friends. You know, I deserve this. I've been home with the baby. I'm, you know, I've worked really hard and I'm doing so well. I deserve this, you know? So I went out and intended to have 2 drinks. And the normal oblivion drinking, blacked out, don't know how I got home, came to the next morning. So that was just kind of an illustration of how I can't drink like normal people. excuse me. So I love the Zoomers too. That's cool. So my disease had progressed at that point. So I knew I needed help. So I agreed, because I wouldn't go back to AA, so I agreed to go to therapy and to start medications. So I figured that would be the answer, to just to see a therapist. And I knew they had some kind of medicine, like, I don't know if I'm depressed, I don't know if I need a medicine for craving, something like that. But I knew I needed help. So I went to I agreed to go to a therapist and started like antabuse and who knows what else they started me on, you know, to try to like stop this nightmare. And I tried everything that I can imaginably get my hands on to fix me. So I did the therapy, I did psychiatrists, I did yoga, I had a bookshelf full of self-help books, to really, like, I knew there was something wrong, but I could not admit that I was an alcoholic. I just knew I was messed up. So I did everything that like was, again, socially acceptable. I did the therapy. I did, took the medications as prescribed, and then I started drinking on top of them. And, you know, I've tried to prove to my family and my husband one time that I could stop. And I said, I'm going to do 30 days and I'm not going to drink, you know? And I was the most miserable human being. No one wanted to be around me. It was like fighting. I remember going into, like, went out to eat one time. It was in this 30-day forced abstinence period. And I went out to eat with family and I was awful. Like, I was that irritable. I couldn't put words to it at the time, but irritable, restless, discontent. I was just confrontational, didn't want to be around anybody, made a scene over something stupid. And, you know, that's what I look like when I'm in a forced state of abstinence, but I'm not treating this disease. So I didn't even make it 30 days. I made it 28. and then I just, you know, again, justified it. So just kind of frantically searching for something to cure this thing, you know, cure whatever was wrong with me. I did psychiatrist, I did inpatient treatment, I think I ended up going to 4 different rehabs, one in California, one in North Carolina, Virginia. But I did like 30 day, 45 day, 28 day. Like I would go and I would clean up and I would get sober. They would like remove me from the alcohol. But then as soon as I was put back into my normal environment, I don't think I would make it more than a week or two without going right back to it. So my disease manifests in a lot of different ways. So that's why I did well with psychiatrists, really, because I looked depressed. I had anxiety. I had an eating disorder. I had self-harm behaviors. I looked like someone who needed psychiatric medication, you know. So I did like an inpatient psych treatment one time, an outpatient program where you had to go for like 8 hours a day for 3 days a week and talk about suicide awareness and talk about what depression symptoms and what meds am I on and checking in about our feelings and, you know, all this time. And I'm drinking at night, you know, I'm doing these treatment programs because I'm a great student, but I'm drinking at night, you know, and, so I wasn't getting better. You know, I was on 8 different medications at one point, and getting worse, not better, getting worse. And I learned later on, you know, in this program, I've learned that even though I looked, and this is not everybody's story. I mean, many people need medications and so forth, but my personal story is I looked to be depressed, but I actually had a spiritual depression. And I now understand that because when I treat my alcoholism with a spiritual program of action and here, all my other symptoms either resolve completely or improve greatly. So, so I don't, you know, by the grace of God, as long as I'm working this program, I don't take any medications. And it's just my personal story, but it's just a testament to how this program can really work, you know, for everything. If that's your primary problem. And for me, that's my primary problem is alcoholism. So what happened? So I liked treatment because it was like my safe place. It was, you know, 3 hots in a cot. I was comfortable. I would get the therapy sessions in treatment. I was removed from any temptations. I liked going to treatment. So whenever I would hit another bottom and I just kept hitting more bottoms, I would go check myself in somewhere. And it was just a safe place to be. Because I knew I couldn't drink in there. So it was like protecting myself from me, basically. And I knew that I was safe. So I would go to treatment. So what happened this time? So it would be December of 2018. I checked myself into Boxwood and stayed in detox there for about a week. But I was actually medically discharged because, and I was ready, right? I was ready to quit drinking. But I was on so many different medications and outside substances and alcohol and mixing so many things together that my blood pressure was what they call refractory blood pressure was not coming down. So they would do like I did IV fluids and put me on the normal medicine in detox to get the blood pressure down and it wouldn't come down. So I was like 230 over something. So they Boxwood medically discharged me. I guess that was a liability. I don't know. They just said, we can't keep you here. Like you're going to need to go. They gave me other resources. Like you're going to need to go to, a hospital somewhere basically. I have this dilemma. I'm ready, but I can't go to treatment, which is where my normal safe place would be. So, I remember going to a meeting. I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the Stepping Up group noon, which was my home group. And went out to lunch with a few women after the meeting. And I remember sitting at that table at the restaurant, just crying and being like, I can't get into treatment. They kicked me out of treatment and I can't do this. Like I can't do this. And I remember one of the women just said, why don't you just do Alcoholics Anonymous? Why don't you just do this, you know, do this thing? Cause they had already detoxed me to where I wasn't physically dependent anymore, you know? So she said, why don't you just do AA? And I had never done that before. I had never really just done AA. So it's a novel idea. So I said, okay, you know, so I worked with a sponsor. I had my sponsor had been with me through that whole detox process and sat with me in the hospital. I was in and out of the hospital a lot the last few weeks of my drinking, getting Valium infusions to stop the shakes and things like that. And so we just started doing this program, you know, and I think I was broken enough to have that little bit of room for God to enter, really, is what it is. So I remember calling my sponsor on day 3 of being sober. And I was in a panic attack, like complete panic attack. And I was still detoxing, I'm sure, and just frantic. And I was sitting in my car and I called her and I'm in the middle of a panic attack, still chemically so out of whack, I'm sure. And I was like, I don't think I can do this. Like, I don't think I can do this. And she was like, Al, you have 2 options. She was like, you can either go back out, you can pick up, you know, you can pick up a drink and whatever your next substance would be. And then eventually you're going to either die or you're going to have to detox eventually. So you can either do that or you can just keep going, you know, just keep going and we can do this together. So I kept going, you know, so I just that was my home group, the Stepping Up group, Noon. And I went there every day. And it was such a God shot because I worked right across the street. I work at the Culpeper Animal Hospital. So it was literally walking distance to this meeting. And I had my lunch break around noon. So I had no excuses at all to miss that, you know, to make that meeting. So I just started going and the days kept going together. And trying to think, you know, turning points for me. So I really, I mentioned earlier being an everyday member of AA. And I think the big thing for me is what I put into this program, I'm going to get out. I remember seeing people in here and looking at all of you when I was in and out of this program for 7 years and looking at all of you and thinking, you know, that's nice that it works for them, but it's not going to work for me. And I was different. I was unique. I, you know, too many things that made me different that I always ways that I could identify out. I was an atheist, right? So I didn't believe in anything. I thought I didn't believe in anything. I was debating the existence of God, debating against the existence of God in bars, dying of alcoholism, but I'm telling you what you should believe. You know, it was just this like rabid state of like, I have to be right and I have to prove you wrong. And it was exhausting, really, in hindsight. So it was in a sense, I think that surrender to know that I don't know, to accept the fact that I don't know the answers to everything. And how arrogant it is to really think that I do know, because I, you know, dying of alcoholism, you know, the end of my drinking was nothing pretty about that. It was nothing glorious. It was nothing romantic. It was me alone drinking boxed wine, room temperature through a straw, because I couldn't get it down any other way. So I would just puke and then I drink it through a straw. And it was just the fastest way to get it into me, stop the shakes. And then I'd just be okay to like carry it out about a normal day, you know? And that's not any way to live, you know? And so I think it was just the concession that I don't know how to do this, that I don't know how to do life, you know, that I really, I heard a speaker say one time that as an alcoholic, my problem really begins where the bottle ends. And I really like that because I would think that I would just get sober and then everything would be good, you know, but it was quite the opposite, actually. Like I had removed the drinking, you know, but then I would get in here and I would get a month or 2 months or 3 months sober. And then if life got uncomfortable enough, or if I got anxious enough, or if I had something go wrong in my life or a problem at work or relationship or whatever it may be, I always had a back door out of here. So I think it's just that, like, how do I stay? It's just a concession, you know, a concession that I don't know how to do life. I don't know how to be a parent. I talked to Billy yesterday when he called about doing this meeting. And I was like, I've had a really hard day, with being a mom. You know, I'm a single mom. I have two girls. So this is a good thing. It's like when you have someone ask you to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous and it gets you right out of self. You know, I was spinning around in my head, spinning about how I'm a terrible parent and I can't do this. And I don't know how everyone else seems to do it, but I can't do it. And then I was asked to do this. So it's just a way to, that I can be available, be of service, get out of self. I mean, self is my problem. And I definitely see that today. So, the more active I am in this program, the more comfortable I am is really what I'm finding. So, what do I do? So today, was also talking with Billy before the meeting about other avenues, other things that I'm doing in my recovery, and which none of which would be possible without Alcoholics Anonymous first and foremost. So having a little bit, 3 years is, you know, but a little bit of a foundation in here and having kind of a foothold in AA, and having worked the 12 steps and being able to now kind of look at other manifestations of my disease, like how else am I sick? Because I know I'm sick. I know I'm still sick. So looking at compulsive pattern, I guess it's 6 and 7, really looking at patterns, looking at behaviors, looking at how I still can definitely be, you know, not spiritually well today. And so my sister, I only have one sister. She's 5 years, almost 5 years younger than me. And we've been doing a women's circle that she manifested. She started, I think it was in September of last year, and it's not recovery based, but it's, I guess it is recovery. If you think about it, it's recovery from a lot of other things, like recovery from Western civilization, maybe, that these women are coming together, you know, and joining together and talking about trauma, talking about birth trauma, talking about abuse, talking about whatever they may be going through, and just having that sisterhood together to work through those issues and have a safe place of support. And my sister asked me if I would collaborate with her and do a recovery circle. So we're doing that next weekend. And so I'm collaborating with her. And just the gratitude, I called my sponsor on the way here. I was talking about the gratitude I have for the relationship I have with my sister today. My sister wouldn't speak to me for over 2 years when we were very close growing up, but she caught the brunt, I think, of a lot of my actions. She caught the brunt of she's not one of us. She's not a heavy drinker, not an alcoholic. But when I would be off, you know, through my teenage years, she was 5 years younger than me. So she would see the wreckage that I left in my wake, you know, when I left home and fled, I talked about my geographic to Georgia. My parents, my family didn't know if I was alive for, I think, almost a year. Christmas, birthdays. So she was there. I mean, my sister was there in that week, you know, as I was off drunk and just doing my thing that I thought was fine. So she had a lot of resentment towards me, and I see that. And it was completely a healthy resentment, if you can have one, but it was a normal reaction, I would say, to the harm that I caused. So I was able to make a formal amends to my sister about a year ago. And I was terrified, but I was able to sit with her and tell her, I know the harm that I caused you. I don't know the depth of it. You know, I wasn't there for a lot of the wreckage, but if there's anything I can do to make this right, I want to do it, you know. And she cried and she, you know, accepted my amends. And ever since then, you know, we've been just growing and our relationship has been strengthening. She has 3 kids under the age of 6. and she is a busy mama. So I help with her children about 2 days a week. And my parents and I help, but I get to drive her kids home. So I have a van full of kids 2 days a week. I have my 4-year-old and then her 3 kids in this van. And I drive from Culpeper to Rixieville twice a week. And I pray that I never lose that sense of awe when I'm driving them home. because I was not capable of driving my own child in the car when I was at the end stages of my disease. So whenever I drive those kids home, I just have a sense of awe and gratitude that I'm like, how did I get here? You know, I have this precious cargo and I look in the mirror and see these little kids, and I'm knowing that I'm sober is just the biggest blessing, I think, in this whole deal. So I get to be I get to be a sister today. I get to be an aunt today, Auntie Allie. And I'm trusted with those kids, you know, and I'm trusted with my own kids. So, just another amends story, I guess. My marriage did not end well. I was served, divorce papers in my third stint in rehab. And it was pretty brutal, you know. But basically through this program, my ex-husband drank like I did, you know, we drank together and were big into the lifestyle. But I didn't know if he was as sick as I was. But he got sober. And so he's about to celebrate 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous in Manassas. And so my daughter has two sober parents now. So I did not, you know, I talk a lot about, you know, what is my life like today because of this program. And even though my marriage ended terribly, and which often happens, I think, in here when we're active in our disease, I have a beautiful co-parenting relationship with him today. So we parent from a place of recovery, which is really, we speak the same language, you know, which is really a powerful place, because I don't have to explain, like, for instance, tonight, I'm going to be late taking her back tonight, and no problem, you know, you're doing a meeting, that's great. So it's just a very unique kind of, and it's only because of this program, and it's only because I made amends to him, and it's only because I get to live this way, you know, one day at a time. So, so that's, you know, just an example of how this program works, that on my own, I burnt that to the ground. You know, I destroyed every shred of decency in that relationship, but through being sober in this program and allowing God to work in my life, my daughter has two sober parents today, and that's beautiful. So, she is such a recovery kid too. Like, I have to be careful because, she does come to meetings sometimes with me. She's 11, but she's going on 30, you know, she's a very mature kid. And I do like take her to meetings. I take both my kids sometimes because I don't have a sitter all the time or at all. But I do have to be careful with how much she thinks she understands, if that makes sense. Like, she, you know, luckily, thank God, her trauma was minimal compared to what many kids and children of alcoholics have. But that said, there was trauma. I mean, she was removed from me with police force at one point. And, you know, I couldn't see my child for several months when I was in and out of treatment. And, you know, so there was some trauma, there was some abandonment stuff. So I have to be careful with how much I allow her to see, you know, like, she knows she's a recovery kid and that's cool. It's really nice to see her grow up in this program, but I also don't want her, I want her to find her own way. I mean, I don't want her to become an alcoholic because she wants to be one of us, you know, I mean, it's interesting, that dynamic. I have to be very careful with what I allow. I want her to see the beauty of this program and how we work and how God works in our lives, and the fellowship that we have and the brotherhood and sisterhood that we have. But I also want her to be a kid, you know, to be a kid and not be so worried about mommy's step work. So one other, my daughter Scarlett is 4, almost 5. So, I got sober when she was about, I guess, 18 months old. And so she doesn't remember, I hope, a lot of my behaviors, but, what happened with her is interesting. So her father and I was, a sick alcoholic relationship, and, moved in with him because I thought I could drink like I wanted to there, really. I was able to, he was an active alcoholic as well. And so, Scarlett was the most beautiful thing that came from that awful relationship, but she's this beautiful result of that. But we had a terrible custody battle. And I don't talk about this very often because it is pretty painful. But I was still drinking and I was fighting for custody of her. I had a great attorney. He had a great attorney. We spent over a year in court fighting back and forth and $25,000 worth of debt over absolutely nothing productive came of it, nothing. But I was so filled with rage and vengeance. I mean, it was kind of the culmination. It was like the peak of my alcoholism, and it was fed by that rage. I think looking back on it, I was doing some reflecting on that. I think that custody battle and the anger and the resentment that I poured booze on really accelerated my bottom. And so I never thought I'd say this, but I think I'm grateful. I think I'm grateful for the horror that we lived through, you know, because I really accelerated my bottom. And I was able to go to that last court date, and I won't go into the details, but I did get full custody of Scarlett. And I was able to go to that last court date instead of carrying a bag of, I used to have like ammunition, you know, papers and pictures and just all the stuff that I carried to try to demonize him and make me look good. I've just brought my chip. I just brought my 5-month chip and a picture of Scarlett. And that's all I brought to the last court hearing. And I ended up getting full custody of that child. So I'm just grateful for that as like an acceleration of my bottom and being able to have both my girls today. So at one point, you know, I was in court fighting for the custody of my one daughter and couldn't see my other daughter because she had been removed from me. So it was just this, to go from that to waking up with both of them on a Sunday morning and making eggs and not having to reach for a bottle today. Not having to have that immediate, I need the next drink fixer pill, you know, that mental obsession that is something that's hard to describe, I think, to people that are not in recovery. It's completely blinding, you know. So I don't have to live that way today. And it's because of this program. So today, and I'll close with this. Thank you so much, by the way, for having me here. It was really, really special. Today, I'm looking into, actually, there's big things. I have a lot. I told my sponsor on the way here, I was like, I have so much happening all at once. And life gets really big sometimes, I feel like, in sobriety. When I was drinking, everything was really small. You know, it was just me and my box of wine and my anger. And that was it. And it was very small. And I didn't worry about, I mean, it was just like a very microcosm that I lived in. And so today, because of this program and because of being active in the fellowship and working with other women, I have a lot going on and it feels really big sometimes. Like I have my sister's circle and I have my home group that I'm working with. And I like just all these women that I'm talking to that were, I'm talking to several women in AA that we're trying to start a step study together. And so it's just beautiful, all these things that are happening. But sometimes it gets big, it gets really big. And so I have to just be where my feet are and try to stay centered. I ask, it was in the daily reflections actually this week. This week's daily reflections was on fire, I feel like. But it was, I use this a lot. I ask God for the grace to find the space between the impulse and the action. So just to be still and have that pause, the sacred pause, and know that all of these things are happening because I'm sober. So none of it would be happening if I wasn't sober. So just staying present, staying focused on my primary purpose, which is just to stay sober today and help another alcoholic and be of service. And this is one opportunity to be of service. So just really grateful to be here. I have both my children in my life today. I have my parents that are very close to me and very big part of my life. I have a sober partner and a beautiful sober relationship today. Again, that's recovery based and really unique and empowering to be a part of and to witness his journey as well and not interfere with it, not interfere with it. Allow him the dignity to recover and not have me meddling with it. It's a learning experience, but it's also beautiful to be able to just be witness to his God working in his life and my God working in mine. So just that parallel is really where the magic is, I think. And I have everything today because of you and this program. So I will close with that. And thank you for my life.